Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining the Ogletree Deacons Podcast. My name is Tim Wolf, and I'm a shareholder in our Chicago office. I'm joined today by my fellow Chicago shareholder, Mike Kramer. Today, we are going to discuss ways to strive for a positive, harassment-free, litigation-free manufacturing work environment. Mike, you have substantial experience advising manufacturers on workplace issues. Would you start us off?
Sure, Tim. Thanks very much. And thanks, everybody, for listening in. I'd like to start with a tale of three manufacturers. First, there's a company, an unnamed company, and let's say we've read about it in newspapers. We've seen articles on the internet and reports on television. It's a manufacturing environment that people might refer to as toxic. There's poor productivity. They see class or systemic litigation around harassment and discrimination. The company experiences major distractions and a huge time commitment from management, HR, and legal, not to mention the fees associated with that distraction. They end up paying out some hefty settlements in the millions, and they get bad publicity. And on top of that, there's been a poor environment where people haven't been as productive as possible or as happy and comfortable at work as possible.
I don't think anybody wants to be that employer.
Most companies do not want to be that employer. That's correct.
Do you have some other examples?
Absolutely. There's another manufacturer that I recently worked with on an investigation. There was conduct involved that led to the investigation that some people in a particular department within this manufacturing company thought was not out of line. Others in the same department, however, found the conduct to be way out of line. The results of this situation were a time-consuming and pretty expensive investigation, a culture and a lack of trust within the department. The trust, to the extent that it was there previously, was really damaged by this conduct that some of the people found way out of line. And highly productive managers within a department are no longer employed there. Now, I will add that there was also, in addition to those results that we wouldn't want to see, a good result. And that was new understanding of the policies within that department and a new commitment to training and living out the policies. And then I'd like to talk about a third manufacturer.
Please share.
This is an actual company that we have worked with for many years. And in the last decade, probably the last 15 years, this manufacturer that has multiple manufacturing sites in the United States and abroad has had no lawsuits and not even any administrative charges alleging discrimination, harassment, or retaliation.
Which is pretty impressive in today's environment. How do you think they do that, Mike?
It's really impressive. Well, they've got a culture of trust and dignity and respect. They've got less distraction. They've also had no union organizing activity, and they have great productivity and just dramatically lower legal expenses. And I attribute this success, Tim, to four things. One, they do have strong policies, as many of our clients do. Secondly, and I think this is very important, they do regular live training on those policies and on the culture that they want to have. Third, they do good investigations, and they investigate things that are brought forward without worrying about credibility before they even start with the investigation. And then fourth, they truly do try to live the policies. And they have a robust human resources and employee relations team that helps foster that environment where people are living the policies.
Well, let's talk about each of these. Mike, I'd like to start out by talking about the policies themselves.
Great idea.
Strong policies are essential, as you pointed out, to creating the type of environment the client that you've worked with and were mentioning. Here, I really think that it can be helpful where the employer has a corporate value of respect, that you align your policy with that corporate value and integrate that concept of respect for everyone who works there into your policy. Of course, your policy needs to hit all the different types of unlawful behaviors that you want to keep out of your workplace. But we have to remember that across the country, that list of laws, that we need to be mindful of can vary from place to place.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you may well want to consider making it the broadest, meet the broadest state's requirements possible. And you can even go beyond that. There are some employers who even incorporate concepts such as bullying, because you don't want that in your workplace either. It may not be illegal everywhere. Some places it is.
But I think that having a policy that touches on bullying does help foster that overall culture of respect that you're talking about.
That's exactly right. And I think we've both seen that that really helps productivity and respect, gets everybody working towards the true goal of the business. Also, having some plain language, giving examples of behaviors that aren't acceptable, so that you don't run into situations like you ran into with the investigation that you were talking about, where some people thought that a conduct was perfectly okay, whereas others did not. Having those types of examples in your policy can be really helpful. So,
agree.
Providing clear, consistent means of reporting perceived violations of the policy is also very important for more than one contact. And sometimes your complaint might be about the individual who's the contact. So you have to have another means of doing that and making it clear and easy for employees to find, and then reevaluating your policy on a regular basis. Now, Mike, the second thing that you had mentioned was training. And I know you've done quite a bit of that. Can you share with us your thoughts on that topic?
Yeah, happy to. And I really appreciated, Tim, your comments on policies. I would add that a couple of things that we see companies doing that we like is, one, if you are operating in multiple states, it may be a good idea to have state-specific addenda. And what we're seeing is that lots of states are starting to have their own very specific requirements for things such as training. So it segues nicely into training. And the other thing is, lots of companies have a corporate code of conduct or an ethics code. And it's best if somebody in the company is making sure that those are consonant with and working in tandem with your policies against harassment and discrimination.
I think that's absolutely right.
You agree?
Those need to work together.
Yeah, agreed. So that takes us to training and your question on that. And in the last couple of years, we've really seen in many companies a renewed emphasis on training. Ideally, if it is possible to do live, interactive, in-person training on your respect in the workplace policies, such as anti-harassment, anti-discrimination, anti-retaliation, we really like to see that. Sometimes that's not feasible because of the size and scope of a company. It's very difficult to do live interactive training, especially on an annual basis. It'd be great if you could do that. And there are good products available online. The trick is, if you're only able to do online or electronic training, how do you make sure that people aren't multitasking during that training? And how do you make sure that they're giving it their full attention?
I think that's right. You want to make this an important part of your culture. And if people aren't there, it's difficult to ensure that they understand how important this is to your business.
Yeah, definitely. And to that point, Tim, one of the things that I like to see is when top management and the most recently hired people who are working on the shop floor get the same training, and that everybody in the company knows the C-suite is getting the same training that we are. I think that helps to send a message that this culture is coming from the top and the top management buys into it and promotes the training. I think that's really good. I think another critical thing is it's important that managers and supervisors understand what to do if they observe something that could be a policy violation or somebody brings a concern forward to them. And, you know, you made the point earlier that the policies ought to give employees multiple channels through which to raise concerns. If you're going to do that, then you want to make sure that the training for managers and supervisors really includes and emphasizes what to do if somebody raises a concern with them or if they see something that leads them to believe, ooh, that may be a policy violation. Without that, people aren't going to feel that the policies are taken seriously. If you go to your manager or supervisor and you raise a concern and your manager or supervisor says, oh, you know, that's just the way Jason acts. Don't think anything of it. Or says, oh, thanks for bringing that to my attention, but then doesn't follow up and escalate that. People are going to feel that they're not being heard. And it's going to be hard to promote that overall culture. And people get angry when they feel like they're not heard.
That's right. That's going to be a critical portion of your training program.
Right. So, I mean, I think typically part of the training, if you're letting those supervisors and managers know, hey, you don't have to investigate these concerns. And in fact, you shouldn't. What you need to do is escalate it to the proper people. And that may be HR in your company or employee relations or even legal. Whoever that is, the managers and supervisors really need to know what to do and the importance of them doing it as part of the training. And then, of course, the training needs to cover the law that's applicable. Some states, including Illinois, for example, now require the training to include what the law says about harassment and discrimination, as well as what the policies say. And to your point earlier, Tim, giving examples and getting people interacting and thinking about, ooh, could this be part of a hostile work environment? What would I do if I saw this or experienced this? I think that giving examples and getting people talking together about those examples can be a really nice part of training if you're able to do that live interactive training.
I think that's absolutely right. Mike, the third point that you raised with us was doing good investigations. Would you share your thoughts on that topic?
Sure. I think this is a topic that we've, you know, our colleagues have done other podcasts on, and we have lots of resources available about doing investigations. But at a high level, the keys to a good investigation, I think, include planning. You ideally should think about, what am I going to do? What documents do I want to look at? Who might be witnesses with relevant information that perhaps we ought to speak to? Who should do the questioning? And sometimes it makes sense to, many times it makes sense to do an investigation internally. And some companies have entire teams in ER or HR who are trained to do those investigations. Sometimes, even if you have such a team, it may make sense to use outside counsel or outside third-party investigators to conduct an investigation. And I think that's part of the planning process. In addition, whoever is going to be asking the questions, you want to think about, if possible, who are we going to talk to? In what order are we going to talk to them? And what are the key things we need to find out? And then as part of the planning and as part of the investigation, there should also be a focus on how are we documenting the investigation? Is there a confidential and privileged report? What does that contain? Who does it go to? And often it may be valuable to think about the idea that perhaps there's more than one investigation report, and there may be multiple audiences and multiple purposes to putting together that report. Sure, you're documenting the investigation, but perhaps a version of the investigation report might ultimately wind up in the hands of a potential plaintiff's counsel, or for that matter, in the hands of the EEOC or a state agency, a judge or a jury. And think about that when drafting different versions of investigation reports. And also, what corrective action is going to be taken and who will that be communicated to? And it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, but one thing that I can say is I recommend that it would be very rare to not get back to the person or people who raised the concerns initially and let them know, we've investigated, here are some of the results of our investigation, and we are taking corrective action.
And Mike, I think a lot of people struggle with what to say to the complaining party. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I don't think it's one size fits all, and there may be times when it makes sense to say to the complaining party, this is the exact corrective action we are taking, and here's why. And sometimes people are disappointed because perhaps they wanted to see somebody fired, and that's not warranted given what corrective action you've taken in similar situations in the past or in connection with the policies and what your findings are. Other times, perhaps somebody raised a concern and had no intention or thought that somebody might lose their job over it. But perhaps this was this person's third offense, and he or she had been warned before about very similar conduct, and the company's left with little choice but to take more drastic corrective action, such as a termination. The issue that is difficult, and we don't have the time in the scope of this podcast to talk about all the possibilities, is exactly what do we communicate and to whom do we communicate it? But that's something that a company ought to be thoughtful about in wrapping up and acting on an investigation.
I think that's right.
Yeah. We also talked, Tim, about the fourth component, in addition to training, but policies, training, and investigations being really living the policies. And I understand you've prepared us a top 10 ways, or at least 10 ways that a company might live their policies.
Mike, I did just that. I've got 10 things I would
I can't wait.
I really like employers to think about. Number one, make sure that your anti-harassment policy doesn't just live in a handbook or in a policy or a poster that's on the wall in the break room. You really want to strive to abide by your policy on a daily basis, to remember what it is. Dust it off. Look at it. Live it. And if you're somebody who's responsible for enforcing it, do so. Live by it yourself. Lead by example. And try to make sure that you are being consistent in applying it to each and every person. I think that this can really help to fostering a culture of mutual respect.
So not only should it be distributed and accessible to employees, but the people charged with enforcing the policy should be continually reacquainting themselves with it?
I think that's absolutely a must if we really want to develop a culture of mutual respect.
Yeah, I think that's a great recommendation. What else?
Second thing is to strive to ensure that your people are trained. You really need to work so that they understand not only the overt types of discrimination and harassment, but some of the more subtle things that can be harassing to individuals, and help them to understand what is and is not acceptable within your work environment. A third thing is to really work to not ignore questionable conduct. Sometimes it can be easier for a person who sees something inappropriate or questionable to look the other way, because it's a pain to write somebody up to deal with that. But you really want to work to address these things anytime that you see them happen, because you can't correct them. And you lose credibility if you're somebody who's responsible for enforcement of the policy, if you're overlooking situations that involve conduct that's not appropriate.
So when possible, you're recommending sort of direct feedback in close proximity to when you observe something.
I think that's the best time to address the conduct.
Right.
Because you can nip it in the bud. To the point you raised earlier, Mike. Sometimes people don't realize what they're doing is offensive to others.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you address it, you can really work towards not allowing it to build up and fester and create a worse situation.
So often you need to investigate, escalate and investigate, we might say. But sometimes there's conduct that you can address immediately when you see something.
Exactly.
Great. What else?
Mike, my fourth point is if you are a manager or a plant manager or somebody in human resources in a plant environment, get out of your office and walk the facility. You want to see and be seen. You need to be approachable. You need to have people know that they can come to you, bring issues to you, and share their concerns. If you're just in your office, it's very hard to see if there's inappropriate conduct that's happening out on the facility floor.
Right. I like that, Tim. So what you're saying is you recommend not just having a quote-unquote open door policy, but opening that door yourself, walking out of it, and talking with people on the manufacturing floor.
That's right. And not just to look at process issues, but to look at how people are interacting as well.
Yeah.
I think that leads into the fifth point, Mike. If you get out of the office, then you can also look at the facility itself. You need to look around. There are any number of cases that have been reported in the news and the courts that have involved graffiti in the workplace, things such as inappropriate cartoons, posters, calendars, inappropriate materials that are being displayed in the facility. You don't want that in your facility.
Sure, that undermines the rest of your efforts if that goes on.
Absolutely.
I'm sure we both could spend the next hour talking about horror stories from environments we've been in that have those problems.
We could. And if you get out and look, then you can see those and help to avert them. Six, you want to be consistent. No one gets a pass. If your best operator is doing something inappropriate, address it with that person. Seven, make it a goal to not excuse improper conduct. You really want to strive to ensure that you are being consistent with everybody every day.
Including management folks.
Indeed. Eight, strive to conduct prompt and objective investigations and do the follow-up on the very points that you talked about earlier. Number nine, don't retaliate against people who make complaints. They have a right to do so under your policy and under the law. And you send the wrong message if you do that. If somebody makes a complaint, you don't want to send that person home or move their shift.
Right. We don't want to take an easily addressable concern about somebody's behavior and turn it into a really difficult retaliation problem.
Indeed. The last point, Mike, is to consider treating your anti-harassment, anti-discrimination policies like your safety culture.
I love that. What do you mean?
So many employers over the last decade or so have placed an enormous emphasis on safety in the workplace, and appropriately so. Doing the same type of program with respect and dignity and proper treatment of coworkers, I think, can have the same type of effect. We shouldn't just talk about these issues once a year at your training. Having them come up on a more regular basis, sharing them in daily team meetings, good examples, providing positive examples of people working together and treating each other well goes a long way. And if we start talking about respect and dignity in the workplace as much as we talk about safety, I think it can have a very positive impact on the workplace and our manufacturing environments.
I think that's a great sort of metaphor and something to strive for that companies could put into place. I like that one a lot.
We hope this has been helpful. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to you joining more Ogletree Deacons podcasts.
Thanks, Tim, and thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.